the Exult podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagelani-Elbov. Today, we are going to be exploring a new facet of extractivism. And I know we keep saying that we're exploring new facets of extractivism, but it's true. We actually are looking at a new facet of extractivism. If you remember back in 2019, we were lucky enough to talk to Maya Lasala, who talked to us about extractivism and art and the intersection of extractivism and art. And today we are joined by another artist who looks at this through a completely different lens. So today, we are really excited to be joined by Mirko Nikolic, who is another artist who, like I said, is looking at extractivism through a different lens. So I don't want to take up too much of the time before we jump in. So Mirko, would you like to say hello to our audience today?
Hello, Sophia. Hello, Christopher. Hello, everyone. Hello, listeners. Nice to be here.
We're so excited to get into this conversation, and we were very lucky to have you at the Exult 2020 Digital Symposium, and you gave us a piece of art there. But for anybody who missed that, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, so I come from the arts, as you said, yes, but nowadays also work across different registers as well. But essentially, yeah, I come from Southeast Europe, Belgrade, ex-Yugoslavia, nowadays it's called Serbia. And I went through art school initially, and with focus on painting and later also performance. And slowly I got drawn into the exploring extractivism, or rather anti and post-extractivism, through practice, and essentially from the starting point of culture. But yeah, now moving also into environmental humanities and looking at also from the social studies perspective, and working also interdisciplinary, post-disciplinary, different sorts. So yeah, it all started from the arts themselves.
Thank you. I mean, that's so fascinating. I really loved reading the work that you sent over that you've done before, The Arcane of Terrain Reproduction, which is, you know, just for our listeners, a really beautiful kind of combination of poetry and more academic cited work. And of course, you're talking about growing up in Serbia. And of course, you talk in here about like the shores of the Danube and a lot of these like very rich ideas of place. So I'm kind of curious, like going back, how did you get into this interest in extractivism beyond the arts? Like, how did these come together for you?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in school and out of school, essentially painting in the beginning. So, you know, and slowly I just started in some ways getting more interested in, you know, the actual material aspect and the action of it, or, you know, the forms. So simply said, you know, I started getting fascinated by, you know, the pigments themselves. And, you know, then the realization was that actually, of course, most of them are mined one way or another. But that was still a bit, you know, I was doing actual landscapes and representations of, you know, how global capitalism actually advances our territories and so on, and sort of, we could call it maybe infographic visualizations of these power relations. That was the kind of subject, let's say, of the painting. But at the same time, the material structure became more and more intriguing for me, and hence I got somehow compelled to actually start investigating a bit these, you could call it, supply chains or the material infrastructure. I didn't start with pigments, but this is, but actually looking into the mineral substrate in some ways. And then I moved into more site-specific work, which meant actually engaging more with places and sites, as you also said. And they somehow turning, like a turning point in some ways, was this invitation I received in, it was 2015, to come to Finland, actually, through Helsinki International Artists Program. And at that time, I came more from the media perspective. And, you know, as many of us living in the cities, it meant, you know, trying to deal with the sourcing of, you know, our digital technologies. Basically, you know, you open the phone and start saying, okay, well, what's going on here? And then coming to Finland was really mind-opening, especially like in mid-2010s. So at the height of, you know, maybe you could say first wave of Finnish mining boom. So I started looking into, you know, exploration activities and how that develops. And well, since then, let's say mining in one way or another has become somewhat of a central point I'm looking at.
In that first trip to Finland, what were you coming here specifically to do, or was it more exploratory?
At that time, actually, yeah, it was both. But I think copper was the first element that kind of was my lead somehow, and then started looking into different exploration ventures around copper, but also different meanings of copper materially, but also culturally, etc. And then actually that connected me with the next stage of that phase of research was actually in Eastern Serbia nowadays, which is where that poem starts with, in a way. And this is considered to be the most ancient copper mining district in Europe. So basically, yeah, mined since 5500 BC. And it is still an ongoing copper gold mining district. So then I spent through the same program, actually, and the network, Frontiers in Retreat. I spent some time in that mining district and basically started really looking into the ongoing processes around it, but also actually really into this deeper understandings and histories and layered histories of extraction that are very present in those areas and the Balkans in general. And so from there, it's been between these two geographies trying to understand what extractivism could represent in Europe historically and today, because of course, as all our listeners well know, of course, the extractivismo comes from another geography as a concept and debate and movement. And so it's not obvious what it would mean in these geographies. So that's still an ongoing research.
So do you remember when you first encountered the term extractivism or the idea of extractivism? Like, I know for me, like, it was kind of a lightning bolt moment when it first entered my understanding. So do you have a moment like that?
Wow. Let me think for a second. That's a great question. Yeah. I don't know exactly the moment when, you know, the word appeared, the concept, but I understand, actually, I can share it. When it did, it really illuminated a lot of things I've seen and to some extent experienced. But essentially, why it was so poignant for me was because of, in a way, what I've just said, that that particular geography, which is this hills and mountains in East Serbia sitting curved around Danube River, actually have had 7,000 plus years of different waves of extraction, and extractivismo discourse actually really makes one really open the eyes to the fact, to the history on one hand, of course, in the case of America, as at least the whole 500 plus years of colonization, and that this whole history is happening now. And it is all there. That's one thing. But also, really, it opens up the eyes to understand actually immediately somehow the real logics behind. So there is, of course, such a big jump to actually go from a mine or mining to actual understanding extractivism. And then at the same time, I've been also spending time here in Finland and Sweden in, for me, quite new environments. Or landscapes, that this would be forest, or, you know, boreal forest. And also, I was lucky to be able to actually meet also some old growth forests here, and actually also quickly to see, for example, the how Nordic, like, you know, Swedish or Finnish forestry, what it does also, and, you know, it started just somehow really making sense. To understand, you know, these definitions that were coming actually from, let's say, the Andes or, you know, Latin America. It has to do really with this, yeah, the speed and the scale of these processes, you know, when you see actually clear cut and, you know, and one really starts looking into the shaping of, you know, the accumulation of value around it and financialization these times and, you know, how these things really are dramatic, create dramatic, like, you know, frontiers, like, in terms of real cuts in the landscape, but also what kind of jumps then are made to actually financialize all this, like by, you know, a mass of wood, which was living, you know, 5 minutes ago. And so, yeah, likewise with minerals. So, yeah, it's kind of just extractivism really opened up to the fact that it is a very complex process that involves so many different, you know, layers and agencies and entities and institutions to make this actually work, this translation, or actually, I would say, reduction of, you know, earth or, you know, nature in some ways to to actual financial value.
It's such a fascinating look. And I mean, like, I really appreciate you bringing out how this like mental journey and as well like artistic journey going from like these ancient sites of extraction and then connecting it to this like modern forestry and stuff like that in Sweden and Finland. Actually, so how did you end up, like, you're in Sweden now, I guess, I don't remember if we had mentioned that earlier, but so how did you end up in Sweden through all this?
Yeah, of course. I'm phoning from Sweden, where I'm doing a postdoc with Linköping University, just a bit south from Stockholm. And it is looking specifically into the extractivist poetics. But yeah, I guess just this conjunction of different processes, I mean, and also then actually starting to understand what this means for, you know, the people who live along in these places, kind of brought up the necessity to really kind of try to orient the work so it actually really is in solidarity with specifically those who actually question this and who don't accept this as normal, because I think that's one of the most dramatic aspects of extractivism as we know it today. We hear also differentially distributed across the different axes of privilege and deprivilege, but essentially the fact that it is essentially normal, that it has been normalized to and quite very successfully with different dynamics in different geographies, but it is something that definitely, you know, is underpinning in so many important ways almost the whole of the modern / capitalist colonialist social, but the fact that it's been so successfully integrated and, you know, normalized, but also this means specifically background, it's just smooth and, you know, it just works its own way through the forest, through the mountains, you know, the rivers and so on, the seas and the oceans and the people. So that's where, yeah, I think that's where, at least for coming from, let's say, humanities, broadly speaking, or, you know, culture and cultural studies, one really starts, you know, we have this thing that, you know, when something is normal, then, you know, what is the story of normalization? How did this happen? And how it operates today? And the exact, you know, to quote you had recently, Alexander Danlev, but, you know, how it is engineered, actually. What is the social engineering of extraction today, but also how it manifests today as a result of different histories and how it is kind of moving itself, you know, towards specific types of future and moving most of the social with itself. So, yeah, I think this is the kind of really interesting question that kind of arises immediately when one starts dealing with this concept is that, you know, where are you? Where do you stand, you know, or lie down, or where are you situated in this? Because it is very hard to conceive one being, you know, on the outside in a kind of total way, at least from the, let's say, European, I would say, perspective. So the whole work now has become a lot around this, you know, following on different traditions of, you know, specifically in my case, you know, and referring to the text you mentioned before, for example, working through the traditions of gender studies from the European perspective, and also materialist studies, and how to actually really find the place where one is, and actually to understand what is the spaces of possibilities of solidarity, that kind of material are possible, and what kind of practices can be done actually to practice these solidarities across quite large differences that exist, even within, you know, the European context.
I think that is such a key, trying to figure out where one is within this larger web. I know that that's a question that I've been thinking about a lot lately, especially as I continue my own study in extractivism, thinking about the things that are completely normalized. And sometimes it's like I find myself completely shocked at like the things that we just accept to be okay because it just is what it is in modernity. But it's like, no, wait, this is all a construct. This is something that we've created and made. And I really appreciate that you brought up Alexander Dunlap's kind of conceptualization of the engineering, because it really is all engineered. But sometimes I really shudder to think, when I sit too quietly and think about where I myself fall into this web of extractivism, because obviously, you know, I don't support extractivism. I think it's awful. But at the same time, there are a lot of aspects of my life where I'm participating in these larger stories. And I guess maybe part of the battle is to try to stay aware of it. But yeah, sometimes I think that I can miss things, even though I'm very aware. I'd like to think I'm very aware, but even certain things just get so missed. And it's amazing that, you know, things like our smartphones, we just have that without going back through to really connect very much to the earlier part of the conversation. When you were talking about literally painting and thinking about the pigments and how the pigments are mine. Like, even that for me was just another little moment of opening where it's like, oh yeah, the paints are mine, of course.
Yeah, I think it is, you know, I simply said iconic this, you know, with a, let's say, modern, specifically now, modern history of painting in Europe, is that, you know, the stories that are not being told is effectively that, you know, how deeper like material but also social entanglements between, you know, this kind of specific class of, you know, of artists, because, you know, that's a very specific European phenomenon which arises in, you know, in, let's say, Italian, you know, city states at that moment, and is allied with a specific type of rising aristocracy and bourgeoisie, and that it is the exact moment, you know, when the kind of modern artist is born are the decades of, you know, Columbus crossing the Atlantic and beginning the project of, you know, world domination and colonialism that kind of went on from that moment. But these are, you know, geographically very connected, but also social. It's very upsetting when one, you know, looks into these histories coming, you know, from traditional arts, or just the fact that, you know, we have this museum that has stored this, you know, supposedly very important, and in many ways, of course, important cultural values, but that actually there are so many other, you know, stories there, and that's just the actual, you know, small peak of the iceberg, and that manifests also in the global trade, you know, of pigments, and how they actually, of course, all come into these surfaces that are, you know, so exhibited there in these ways, you know, stand there in such proud ways. But, you know, this brings us to today's, you know, when you say smartphone, that's actually a very similar type of manifestation. The fact is, quite simply said, that, you know, it is normalized violence. So, and that's the kind of, I guess, for me at least, and that's where I would like also to bring in, kind of, again, Southeast Europe, is that, you know, the marker is, because of course, you know, there have been different types of extraction, let's say, or relationships with the natural environment, so many ways and so many geographies, but so many peoples. But when we speak about extractivism, actually, the kind of, for me, one of the real, like, you know, markers is, you know, this normalization of violence and how specific it is, you know, how specifically it is engineered, controlled, but also absolutely perpetuated. And, you know, this fact, how is it neutralized, you know, how it is rendered socially acceptable and even actually socially necessary, because now it's interesting about it, is because that's one of the big parts of the, you know, the whole apparatus, is this kind of also presentation, it is a kind of socially necessary to some extent, you know, this idea that, you know, someone needs to be sacrificed for this specific greater good, which is essentially never exactly public good in a, maybe in a fully democratic way and especially just way. I don't know, maybe I will avoid not going on to a deeper rant, but I just want to bring in violence immediately at this stage. Yeah.
No, totally. I hope you do go into a deeper rant. I actually kind of want to bring this out even more, because this is something that kind of popped into my head, especially as you were talking. With extractivism, at least like Gudinius, when he talks about it, is, you know, not all mining is extractivism, not all agriculture is extractivism. Like, you know, it's very particularly modeled way. I mean, although I don't fully agree with all of the caveats he puts on, I think in a historical way, looking at this, looking at the long-term view, because, you know, there are some arguments that extractivism does go well even before colonialism. And as you were talking before about like this 5,500 BC mining going on in the Balkans for copper and gold. And, you know, I think of how this has come up in some of our past conversations, like when we're talking with Beryl Jakla about Kyrgyzstan. When you hear in the news today, especially about like mining culture in like Poland or like parts of the UK or something like that, where it's these ancient mining towns that like, you know, the government's not moving away from coal or something like that because they're dependent on these votes and these people, like the extractivism of it has actually become not just socially necessary, but a part of pride in what they're doing. Like it's gotten into like the soul of the community. But so I guess I'm just kind of like, I'm really kind of curious to hear more about this. Looking back at this history, because I don't know the history of mining in that region at all. So I'm kind of curious, how is it in public consciousness? Is there this like community pride in doing it? And also, is there kind of a time when maybe it was, you know, a bit more socially and naturally okay, or at least less damaging, like the more basic artisanal stuff? Like if there's a kind of general time there. I know that that's a lot of big questions and perhaps too specific in some areas, but I do want you to go off on a rant on this. This is like fascinating to me.
Yeah, well, there are many stories, of course. And, you know, I'm not an archaeologist, a paleoarchaeologist or such, to make this clear. And also some parts of history actually are, you know, not registered apart from the, that's also important, apart from the, you know, the hegemonic histories. But what I'm interested, yeah, I can't draw lines there, you know. I don't think it's actually open, it's, you know, I don't think it requires specific type of analysis and work, but I definitely would agree with what you said. That's what I mean by understanding from the, let's say, European perspective, what kind of work we need to do actually to understand this better. It requires specific type of work, starting from, you know, this part of the formulation by Acosta and Godinez, in some way that it has to be mainly for export. But, you know, what is actually export? In some cases in Europe, I think it's important to argue that actually export can be internal, but it is about creating a periphery. So within even one land or country, can we, I think that could be considered export actually. Because I think that's what you said before. Of course, there are very long histories in Europe, but I think it's also about reversing kind of somehow these questions, you know. Like I think, you know, there is a really good example. A fairly recent research reveals a trail of lead toxicity in a swamp plant in it's actually West Serbia, which goes, which runs from 3000 plus BC to essentially today. So it's also actually this trail of toxicity, for example, something maybe we should follow rather than the dominant narrative, you know. How did this and that's where I think your perspective from this kind of, let's call them sort of micro history, someone would say, but actually perspective from the body is really crucial, you know, that these processes have actually marked bodies, simply said, even when they were relatively small. And of course there is really big distinctions to be made, you know, between different types of mining through history, in terms of scale and intensity and speed, absolutely. But I think that's exactly for one of the big real zones that actually I think needs careful exploring in Europe is, you know, when the boundaries are crossed, boundaries of the, you know, ecosystem, social boundaries and so on. But I think one way, actually, again, looking at it, is I think another marker that I really think is very good to start detecting extractivism is, you know, to really look at the issues of consent. But specifically, you know, I think it's a crucial formulation to look to at, you know, free, prior and informed consent. And of course, it can be criticized, and you know, it's a specific, of course, universalist actually kind of ideal in some ways, and of course it has its own complexity, but still I think it's a very interesting important guideline to look at operations that are going without free, prior and informed consent. And when one starts actually looking at it even retrospectively and today, I think that really casts a light on it, that actually I would say that extractivist operations always proceed without this. and specifically without having all these three. Even there could be other parameters, there should be, but the fact is that there has not been three prior informed consent for almost any large-scale modern mine. I don't know if we could find one, but I think that's a really important question also to ask. You know, can we say, can anyone say that, you know, any of these operations has had a real community consenting on these terms, wherever, even in the old mining districts and so on, to, you know, where are all the stories of those who actually thought differently, you know? And that's when we start looking at, you know, how deep it goes and, you know, what is the consequences on it, because that's where also I think that this violence is actually, you know, or conflict specifically also, then circulates, you know, and then we can see it also, as you say, from the Balkans perspective. I think it's also really important, actually, you know, as you said, that, you know, there have been many different empires, like throughout the history, you know, and many actually digging, or all of them digging, and some of them quite closely connected to the actual mining industry, for example. And, you know, this gives us, at least in Europe, an understanding of, you know, the nexus between extractivism, colonialism, and imperialism, and their inextricability, actually.
Absolutely. I think that the consent is such an important key within all of this. And that's actually something that Christopher and I have been exploring a little bit. We've been working really specifically on data extractivism and looking at the expansion of the extractivist logic into the digital and data realms. And that's actually one of the things that we really turn on, of course, coming off of Koldri and Mejias. They inspired us to really look at that consent and what that means. So yeah, I think that that's a really, really important aspect of this. And then also asking too, like, whose consent? I mean, is it just the consent of the people? What about the consent of all the other beings that exist within a particular space? So is there even any way when we're making these, we, whoever we is, when these large projects are being made, I mean, is there even any actual mechanism to truly get consent? I don't know. I don't think so, personally.
Yeah, I mean, that's really core, I guess, of the issue, right? That, you know, what would be the, you know, possible, like, protocols, or are there any, specifically now talking always from the, you know, European perspective, for, you know, asking for consent from, you know, natural bodies or, you know, environments. But again, of course, some of the answer to that is, you know, contained in rights of nature work and framework. So that's part of it, but clearly for some types of projects, you know, they are so destructive that it would be very hard to imagine what kind of consent could be given, you know, so which then opens up a set of other questions, you know, which I think are really important. You know, should we even have specific types of, you know, projects at all? Because that it comes down to that, especially now today in the climate crisis. But, you know, also to go back, I think it's really interesting to also go really, and that data extract is really, as you say, is crucial here, because in some ways, I think also, didn't mention, but, you know, I come into this also from, you know, media perspective, and actually copper was one of the leads for me because of course, you know, it's ubiquity in terms of, you know, wires, and it's simply, it's impossible to have electricity, you know, electrical power without copper. So hence IT, hence data extractivism. So to look into this totalizing logic of, you know, what is the kind of the lowest denominator, I would say we are the somehow very lowest denominator of what consensuality is. Because it's good to, I think, go through, you know, the kind of these parameters of, you know, freedom, you know, priorness, prior and informed. And, you know, just to give an example, to really challenge the whole, you know, apparatus, but also somehow the kind of epistemology and ontology that comes with it, is that actually, you know, it's really hard to imagine how it would work with, you know, for example, a mine, say, to obtain this full consent on all the in all these terms, because I think, you know, in some ways some parameters can be fulfilled, but to have actually kind of free in sense of pressure free, you know, decision making, while at the same time, for example, just, you know, on this podcast people talked about this much more, but, you know, for example, you know, Extractor is one of the is a cultural force in the sense that, you know, it is on the kind of progress. And so how can the context where, you know, progress is so deeply tied with extractivism, when you say, you know, oppose or question a project, actually, how can it be actually free in a society which actually creates a specific valuation where, you know, there is a very specific kind of hierarchy of what the progress is, socially speaking. So where, how is it that, how do exactly we obtain a freedom, for example, to determine, you know, that actually, you know, in this, you know, land here, agriculture, you know, or as we know now, we're in Sami lands, you know, and that's one of the core issues is again, this valuation, or like in Sweden, you know, how do you put on the same terms, you know, specific type of nature-based livelihood with metal-based modernity, for example, it has to do with freedom. Then prior, of course, you know, it's clear that, you know, most of the projects of all sorts of, from infrastructure to, you know, energy projects, all sorts of, you know, it's always such an instrumentalized timing that actually, you know, that by the time it's being asked for consent, you know, it's very rarely, we could say, prior, because, you know, even the reservation of an area for exploration is already a big act, and it's very often, you know, done already. And then so this already reshuffles totally the social context and everything. And again, to speak about informed, I think is really interesting on so many levels for all extractivists. But, you know, in mining, for example, I bring it up because it's happening now, and it's a very important, like, new element we have now in the Balkans. There is a lithium rush. There is actually multiple lithium projects, and, you know, it is of course presented as absolutely socially necessary, and also being actually presented in a kind of whole new, you know, discourse, in the sense that it is absolutely necessary to avoid, you know, climate breakdown. So it is actually climate action to dig for lithium, as well as cobalt, nickel, and all other transition minerals. But in that context here, now speaking about lithium, you know, it is absolutely astonishing to see how do you, for example, talk about informed consent when effectively some of these technologies, for example, that are supposed to be used, and the actual environmental consequences are under-researched effectively. There is not enough research. How do we speak about, you know, even due diligence and so on, when often, as in the case, you know, another case we should definitely bring here is, you know, and always, is, you know, Talvivaara / Terrafame, where actually, of course, what essentially happens, it's a huge, of course, enormously complex topic, but essentially it is an experimental process moved from a laboratory onto a scale of, you know, million times bigger scale in terms of volume of processing and scale. How do you actually inform the public about this when actually, you know, there are effective barriers to technology and science, and, you know, not to start off, of course, of all the power asymmetries that come with the fact that, of course, like in some respects, extractive industries today, like, and we've seen this in oil and gas, for example, you know, like when we see like BP, Exxon and Shell, you know, for example, in climate science, they actually, at their moments in time, I think this is a really important part also to draw that, you know, like now we know a posteriori, many decades after, that actually the oil companies had the most advanced climate science way before there was a public, equal public independent knowledge around this. And, you know, how do we talk about informed really there, you know? Because such, I think, for specific also types of materials today, there are these asymmetries that are really deep, that actually industry research, property research, patented research is, you know, now speaking just about, you know, this kind of knowledge aspect, which I know you're also fascinated with in some ways, you know, how do you actually talk about any sort of real just informing when it's a lot of it is property, you know? So, yeah, just to bring in also this aspect of, you know, knowledge extractors, and it's of course deep embedment with knowledge structures.
Definitely. And I mean, I think you touched on so many great things there. And something that always really struck me about extractivism when I was first starting to get into it, there's this part of me that I guess perhaps it's a very Western privileged sort of position, but I think of like the sort of liberal suburbanites that I would know back in the US who would be shocked and appalled by so many of these horrible practices going on. And the like, you know, and they would ask, how can we let, like, how did we let this happen? And of course, that of like has all kinds of overtones of paternalism and things like that. But I think there is an important question in there of the like, how do these things happen? How can this happen? And I think that those like asymmetries of knowledge and asymmetries of power are just so key to it. But I'd never thought of it like necessarily in the terms of connecting to consent. But like, yeah, it is so obvious when you put it that way. Because in any way, if you look at a project, yeah, you could have asymmetries of knowledge from the extractive companies. You could also have in terms of like the asymmetries of power within a community or a particular like political area of the government really wanting this to go through. So not really allowing people who have dissenting voices to talk or look into things. And of course, then this ties back to that nexus of imperialism and colonialism and just abusive power. Historically far back enough, there wasn't even an issue of consent. It was like, do it or we will kill you, or you could run away. And like, if we catch you, we'll kill you. But this is going to happen because we said so. And like, yeah, it's such a, like, I really never thought of that kind of like trace from, you know, thinking back to, especially when you talk about like the long history of the Balkans, thinking back to say like the Eastern Roman Empire, going back and forth with like Bulgaria and like the Slavs moving in and everything like that, but like constantly retaking this land largely for resources. But yeah, that sort of imperial power still keeping through for thousands of years to force through extractivism for the benefit of a few. Yeah. So it's anyways, yeah, thank you for that. I really, really never thought of it that way.
Yeah, I think really bring in now, you know, I think that's really crucial is also, you know, the question of, you know, labor and how all this also should be mapped or absolutely be integral to, you know, this idea of consent into the labor perspective as well. And, you know, what is free, prior and informed consent to do work, do a job? And because actually the European history, and here I will refer, you know, among others, but you know, I think it's a very powerful reading, is, you know, Silvia Federici's, you know, Caliban and the Witch, and more broadly, there's a lot of other work along, historical work along these lines around the, you know, birth of, let's say, capitalism and colonialism, is that, you know, when one looks, you know, Peter Linnabaugh's work on commons and so, but actually, when one works in this, let's say, early stages of capitalism within Europe, we actually see that it's been actually centuries of, you know, of actual conflict in order to normalize wage labor. Like, wage labor is a very recent and modern invention, and it's been a specific type of instrument or social contract to some extent that's been imposed for specific interests or been generalized or totalized. And it's been a, you know, very, very long process of actual that involved both, you know, enclosures of land, displacement of people, internal displacement of people, displacement also, of course, also beyond the frontiers, but effectively displacement from the land and actually kind of putting into the, you know, what we could say, factory, like as a kind of genesis or, you know, the coal mines in some ways. And I think that's kind of gives us a lot of answers today because, you know, can we, when we look at this crucial, you know, I come into this, you know, this is like a really huge quandary for, from the, you know, our, you know, post-socialist perspective, or, you know, I come from the socialist context and, you know, Marxist studies and so on. So of course, the history of labor is crucial and there is all these traditions and they're really important. And they have actually really created a lot of, and democratized partially, you know, some good for the societies and communities. So that's my starting point. And, you know, now today we have, you know, often this conflict that is actually being generated, for example, between jobs, you know, at the mine, you know, like, so essentially still very, very huge number of, let's say, pressures that create settings where, you know, there is this binary. And again, now we come to the question of binary, actually. I think that's interesting. I haven't brought it up before, but the communities are being faced with this idea, you know, either jobs or the lake, you know, so either water or, you know, gold. And, you know, and but these are unfair and unjust choices. There can, I don't think in that context can be consent, because they are looking into, you know, practice differently, harmful and toxic potentially, and conflictual. So how do we get there? I guess that's what you said, what you asked before. I think that's the key. And I think that, yeah, the history of labor gives us these really important insights, and specifically the history also of labor movements, essentially. But yeah, you know, with what degree of certainty can we claim today, like, where is the line between free and unfree labor, actually? You know, and there is some really crucial issues there, because, you know, when we start looking closer, we actually see that a lot of, you know, most illuminated parts of, you know, European progress, even within the continent, have been built, for example, on child labor or different types of unfree labor. Of course, this on a much, much higher scale, implemented beyond Europe in the colonies, let's say. But I think that's where it's really important to also look at Federici and definitely feminist materialist readings of this, that actually these processes have been implemented both internally and, let's say, exported overseas, but that they are really connected. Of course, the levels of conflict and violence are different, and the has to do with, you know, the slavery, of course, the institution of slavery and it perpetuating. But the question of, you know, what is the line between free and unfree labor or forced labor, I think is really complex, and we need to look into that. Because, you know, even when you go back into, you know, data extractive, as you say, or even our, like, let's say, more or less our here, you know, cognitive labor jobs, you know, can we fully say that we are consensually some of these relations, you know? Do we know, you know, all these contracts? How do we have a power to actually enforce them? How do we do? You know, so I think it's a really important question to continuously ask. Yeah, and that's why I think also extractivism really shows, you know, its way through into many, many other places. As I know, even beyond, you know, the classic reading, but as you said, also moving into all kind of many, many pores of the current capitalist paradigm of today. Yeah, or modern, sorry, the whole history of modern capitalism.
I found this really interesting. I guess this is getting definitely into more specifically labor and class stuff, but seeing this around now, and I look at the, you know, unfortunately, I bring things back to the US a lot. That's the context I grew up in. But of course, you know, internationally, it always gets a lot of press. But there's a lot going on right now with fast food places and low wage businesses having trouble actually attracting workers back, because with the COVID relief stuff, there's been extended unemployment insurance and, like, you know, increased benefits for people. So now that things are opening up again, these, like, traditionally very bad, like, jobs where people are often horribly mistreated at work and, you know, make the bare minimum that you can't survive on, are suddenly not wanting to go back. And you see a lot of right-wing people, like, arguing, we've got to get rid of all of these benefits for people because the businesses aren't running. And it's like, well, if people have got, like, if they are no longer, like, literally forced to go do it to survive, like, it's, like, literally not better than basic social welfare. Don't you think maybe that should mean that the jobs themselves should be better, or I mean, like, get better in terms of like working conditions and pay. So it's an interesting thing of like seeing this actually a moment of consent or the possibility of consent because of COVID-19, and seeing especially the right wing backlash of, wait a minute, we can't actually have real consent here, otherwise our hamburgers might be slightly more expensive, or really the CEOs will make less profit. But yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that whole conversation is just like the focus is on the wrong thing. It should be on like, it's not that you have to get rid of the benefits. It's like, let's actually do a good job here and make this a more attractive job. I mean, my goodness, it's not like the corporations can't afford it. Like everything gets so skewed through the lens of modern capitalism. It's really depressing sometimes. I find it depressing. I don't know why I'm laughing when I say it's depressing. Maybe because it's so depressing. You can either laugh or cry, but yeah, it's really interesting to look at that also through that lens of consent.
Yeah, I think this also brings, the COVID crisis and, you know, how differently it impacted different sectors. Again, puts another core, I think, question related to extractivism in front of us. And that is, you know, what is really, you know, essential. And now it's a loaded word because, you know, it's clamorously, for example, you know, the mining industry has been able to, in most of the world, for example, to claim itself to be essential service and keep running through the COVID crisis, even in very vulnerable communities, and to fast track projects sometimes, and, you know, to actually, for example, qualify itself as essential. And then, you know, there's been a lot of debate what's essential on so many levels. But I think this brings also to the Gudinas' question, you know, where he is, you know, together with others, drawing a path towards, you know, in for a post-extractivist transition. And he speaks, for example, about, you know, essential extractivism in order to, you know, transition. Now, it's specific analysis. I'm not necessarily going to go there, but the question of, you know, essential and actually how is it being decided? Again, what most of these, you know, services we have today and technologies have not been actually collectively, justly, democratically decided, simply said, or determined even, you know. These were not actual choices. That's, we go back to the somehow to also the fact that extractivism per se has been this, and I think that's why really beyond, together with all the, you know, political economy analysis, you know, geographical analysis, you know, all quantitative as well, all the earth sciences, it's really crucial to look at it as the actual cultural system, and more specifically maybe even as a belief system, you know. And this is also, again, applies specifically to capitalism. And, you know, that, you know, it's based on specific actual beliefs that do not have material grounding, such as, you know, unlimited growth, for example, or, you know, just that even more basically somehow with capitalism, that, you know, unexpectation, you know, that because without expectation, there is actually like capitalist expectation to grow, expectation of profit, different types of expectation of surplus, because that's where actually kind of extractivism really is kind of bottom up. And this relates to also what I talked a bit before, like, you know, in terms of extractivist technologies, that actually, you know, there is a specific type of quantification of belief in the sense of, you know, we do this type of project, we open this mine, and, you know, to the specific set of standards, detailing them, and, you know, it's what is required partially legally, what we can do scientifically, technologically, but at the end of the day, you know, like, we cannot model, of course, 100% that this is going to stay in place. So there is this fundamental belief that it will be okay. But it's really important also, again, look into, you know, and here again, I'm drawing a lot of from, you know, science study, I mean, feminist science studies or sociology of science, to actually also look how it is constructed and how this nexus of science, technology, and power always, that actually, you know, how is it that it becomes socially accepted this degree of, let's say, risk to be more, you know, policy oriented? But I really think belief is an important word also. But actually, we believe, or it is, you know, socially constructed as that we believe that it will be okay to cut down, you know, to clear cut this amount of forest here, and then wait for the specific amount of years, and you know, things will happen. While at the same time, there is a lot of course, knowledge and science that actually understand that, you know, we are always reducing it this way. We can never cover all the parameters. We can never really understand the whole ecosystem ever, and so on. So, you know, that there is this really strong reproduction of like, you know, that we just do it, you know, and then, you know, if the bad things happen, you know, well, actually there is insurance maybe, and maybe we can remediate, or, you know, there is a specific amount of accepted risk. And even it's, of course, a whole market for risk. And, you know, the actual insurance is really also important to talk about here, but I'm not an expert on it. But, you know, how all this is constructed. So actually it is, you know, sound and solid and firm, while at the same time, it's all actually to the bottom of it experimental. Like these types of big interventions kind of, you know, do they scale up? Can they scale up? You know, it's not the same, you know, to say, okay, we did this here and we do it there and with this amount of trees, or, you know, this big amount of ore. You know, it's, you know, how is it actually, as you said before, allows to, how do we get there when the tailing dam, you know, bursts or a bridge falls or such and such? And actually we get there. Yeah, exactly. We do get there. And it doesn't have to do with, you know, revenge of nature or even, you know, some other explanation. It's just that we get there. We, or communities are being put there through a specific type of, you know, process, which is very far often from what we spoke about before, which would we could call for now, you know, just consultation and free prior informed consent of everyone involved.
Yeah, not only do we get there over and over and over and over until even getting there has become its own industry. You know, there's a whole industry of remediation that would probably be very upset if we stopped getting there and make their own resistance. It's a tangled, tangled web.
Wow. I mean, we've gotten into so many amazing points here. And I know we could just keep going. We definitely need to have you come back on the show so we can keep teasing these ideas out. But I know that it's getting a bit late and, you know, we're running out of time. So I think it might be a good time to get to the question.
It's question time.
So, Mirko, every time we have somebody on the show, we always like to ask the question. And so this is a call to action. Like, what can our listeners, like, what can they do? Maybe it could be something they could read, someone they can get involved. If your average person on the street was really taken and they want to do something, what do you have to suggest for them to do?
Okay, yeah, we've got so much work to do. But specifically for that our average listener in Europe, somehow I address this to them. But of course it's for everyone, but specifically for those of us privileged or deprivileged of being in Europe, and maybe even specifically more in the EU. To specify this a bit more, because also we failed to mention, but it's really, then these dynamics really have specific connotations, you know, for example, looking into these questions from the Balkans perspective, because it's the actual semi-periphery of the EU, and we didn't get into the discourse of the semi-periphery. We might next time, but for someone in the EU, that we really need to look very carefully into, you know, the, let's say, European Green New Deal, and, you know, the solutions being proposed, because there's a lot of work from colleagues and mainly the civic society, actually, and experience and evidence from the communities showing that actually the Green New Deal and the green transition as it's being planned, at least on the big scale, or you know, the industry and governmental and specifically EU Commission perspective, is hardly going to achieve this type of justice we spoke about, which we also call climate justice, but also this real social justice in terms of these different types of consent. And essentially, EU is heading for a really big wave of extractivism, possibly unprecedented wave of extractivism, actually, even if it's possible from European perspective. But yeah, the story goes, as I'm sure many of you know, so apologies for repeating, but it's too important not to be repeated over and over, specifically because there is a lot of work being invested into actually greenwashing this whole process. But yeah, the actual raw material action plan of the EU and the associated industry alliances are not promising us a just transition under some of the terms we mentioned before, or justice transition, and specifically do not promise a post-extractivist justice transition for the continent, because of course the trust of these plans is twofold: is a continued import from the extra European countries, from the so-called global south or third countries, so to continue these massive imports, and actually to ensure through also often not exactly consensual trade agreements these insourcing, at the same time also to open many new mines, or to scale up extra mining industry within Europe. So simply said, as the petition recently signed in by hundreds of organizations in September 2020, as a response to the raw materials action plan by the EU, says we can't mine our way out of climate crisis. And this is exactly what Sophia, you mentioned, actually, that we keep getting there and there, and it shouldn't have happened many times before, but now, and you know, in the moment of climate crisis, there is very likely no space for anyone in Europe and beyond Europe to actually keep getting there by using the same or even similar means, just greenwashed. So in that sense, I think we should all be informed, because oil and coal and gas had gotten all the much deserved fire they have to get. But we really need to understand much better what is going on with all these other materials that are being labeled as necessary and essential for the green transition. So the European Green New Deal is for whom and by whom? That's crucial, I think, for us in the EU now. Yeah, and to always again acknowledge and really understand the ongoing colonial legacies and colonial presence of Europe within its own boundaries. And again, we must say here in Fennoscandia, to a large extent, we are indigenous Sami territories, so that this is the center of all these discussions. And the patterns of specific nature resource extractions, extraction outside EU are, yeah, continuum of practice. So, yeah, we cannot get on with any discussions of Green New Deals and so on without, yeah, decolonization, right? And this also brings also the questions of centers, always the question also of labor, and you know, the real understanding and solidarity, and also the question of the huge social crisis of refugees and migrants in Europe, and all these interconnections that are absolutely essential and inextricable from one another. Otherwise, it's just more of the same.
I think that's a fantastic answer to the question. And I think that will give our listeners a lot of food for thought about things that they could do, and a good reminder to always keep in mind both the historical trajectory that's gotten us to this point, and also really keeping a critical eye on the things that are given to us because of those power indifferences and lack of consent. So yeah, we've got to keep those critical eyes sharp. So if our listeners are interested in learning more about the work that it is you do, is there anywhere that they can find you online to find out more about some of these topics that we've touched on today?
nothing comes to mind like now at this point because it was such a dense conversation. Yeah, sorry.
Well, no worries.
Mirko, thank you so much for those fantastic conversation, fantastic answer. And, you know, just great time overall, like really looking forward to the next time and looking forward to, at the very least, catching you this fall at the Exalt conference.
Yeah, absolutely. For anybody who doesn't already know, we are having a conference for the Exalt Initiative from October 25th to the 27th. It will be happening in Zoom, and we are going to be joined by approximately 66 presenters, including Mirko. And so it's going to be a pretty good time for 3 days in late October. And there's no charge to attend, so everybody is welcome. Registration will be opening closer to the end of summer, but you can believe we're going to remind you a lot of times.
Thanks to you both. It's been really an honor and privilege and a joy to speak to you both. And say it once more, need to join forces and work for a truly just post-extractive transition.
A big thank you to Mirko Nikolic for coming on and having such a fascinating conversation with us. Please join us next month for what will be surely a fascinating and wide-ranging conversation with Arturo Escobar. From the blooming flowers and lengthening days of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, stay safe, and we'll catch you next time.